Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. There is a shaky ceasefire. It's taken hold in Syria, and talks are underway to de-escalate the conflict in this Middle Eastern nation. The battles have been waging there for 4 years, 500,000 killed, 4 million turned into refugees. Concerns are that if unchecked, this civil war could continue to widen and further destabilize the region and Europe with a refugee crisis. And with us now to tell us what is happening with Syria and the ceasefire, David Lesh, the UN Halsell Distinguished Professor of History at Trinity University, author of 14 books, including Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. He was in Brussels and Geneva during the January-February negotiations, as well as he was part of a small group of advisors to the UN Special Envoy in Syria. And welcome back to The Source, David.
Thanks, David. Good to see you.
So you just got back from Geneva and Brussels. You saw the negotiations taking part. What is happening there? What is the mood? Is it still bonkers?
They're trying to find a needle in a haystack. The mood amongst the negotiators, amongst the participants, is very glum, to say the least. It's very negative. But as a good friend of mine who's a top UN official told me one time, and he's focused on Syria for several years. He's been in Damascus for a number of years, put his life in harm's way a number of times. He said, you have to try. You have to try something because people are dying, as you said. The refugee crisis, the internal displacement crisis in and outside of Syria is starting and has affected well beyond Syria. So you have to try something, and I think that's what the UN is doing. And they finally have the support of Russia and the United States, who seem to be fairly closely aligned in terms of trying to get negotiations started between the so-called legitimate Syrian opposition and the Syrian government. There are many, many obstacles, which I'm sure we can discuss. But the mood is not very positive. The cessation of hostilities, what's officially called, is by its nature very temporary. I think it's a very low bar for satisfying the cessation of hostilities because there still is a lot of fighting going on. And the Syrian Opposition High Negotiation Committee that is the official negotiating body for the opposition, comprises some 100 groups, but Syrian armed opposition groups. But there are over 1,500 to some say 5,000 opposition militias all over Syria. So, trying to get everybody on board. And, of course, this doesn't include Jabhat al-Nusra or ISIS, the jihadist Syrian opposition, and this just may be the hardest, most complex attempt to bring about a cessation of hostilities in modern history.
It's so hard to figure out who the players are or who your opponent is. There are four major factions involved, and so the United States. Supporting, of course, the Turkey and the Kurds, and we want to get rid of Assad because of humanitarian acts of inhumane acts against his own people. But also ISIS, we're against ISIS, but ISIS is also against Assad. Russia, they're involved too, and they're bombing the supposedly supposed to be bombing ISIS, but they're not. They're really bombing the free Syrian rebels that we have been supporting since the very beginning, first in secret and now out in the open. It is a fur ball of trying to figure out where does one part begin and another end.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen these spreadsheets or flowcharts that are been constructed by governments, UN, and other groups, where they try to figure out who is for what and who is against who, and you have all these crisscrossing vectors and arrows, and you get a headache trying to figure it out and look at it.
And this is important when you're at the negotiating table because you're trying to establish common ground, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so the one thing that the United States had been insisting upon is that Assad could not remain in power. And that was something that Russia was saying, Putin was like, no, we back Assad. And so if we come out of this with find a way to actually restore stability to the area and Assad is still in power, does that mean the United States lost?
Well, first of all, I'm going to say Soviet Union as well at some point because we're both children of the Cold War.
Yeah.
And they're acting. I mean, a lot of what's going on now reminds me of the Cold War, superpower Cold War period. Look, both the United States and Russia, they are trying to find an off-ramp out of this. The United States made, I think, and the West made a big mistake early on in this conflict back in 2011, 2012, by assuming that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad would fall quickly, as had other authoritarian leaders in other Arab countries during the 2011 so-called Arab Spring. So that really backed the United States into a corner. We've been trying to edge away from that because now we realize, especially with the Russian military intervention, that Assad isn't going anywhere. He isn't. It's just not going to happen with Russian military intervention, with Iran helping out. And so we've tried to find some middle ground. And, you know, both Russia and the U.S. Want this conflict to end somehow in a way that satisfies their particular, the minimum level of interest. Russia, I just had a good friend of mine and colleague come back from Moscow, and she was in discussions with Russian officials, unofficial discussions with Russian officials. And she said the Russians are very worried about a quagmire getting in Syria, a la Afghanistan, even though they don't have nearly the military commitment in Syria. But they've gone all in many respects. You know, they are, as the U.S. said, the burden is on the Russians to make this happen in terms of bringing bringing about a ceasefire, a cessation of hostilities that will create
a fertile
environment.
Right, and you can see from Putin how enthusiastic he was about achieving this ceasefire because he went on national television in Russia immediately afterwards and told the people about it, that this is happening. Yep. Here in the United States, it was like, you know, it was a back page story in a newspaper.
Yeah, I think the Obama administration, is of the mind that if a diplomatic settlement comes out of this, that's great, that's fine, but we're not really going to help the Russians bring it about. And if they get involved in a quagmire, if it breaks down, you know, we'll be there to say, look, we told you so. And the problem right now, and what I think Moscow is afraid of, is that if this potential window of opportunity for a negotiated settlement does break down, there are powerful voices in the Obama administration in Washington that have long been pushing for a more aggressive U.S. policy, assertive U.S. policy, particularly in arming the opposition more so than we've had. And the United States has some aces up its sleeve in this regard, particularly perhaps with the giving a green light to allies to provide surface-to-air missiles, Stingers, MANPADS, which is fraught with all sorts of problems in and of itself, which is why we haven't done so. But that was the determining and changing factor in the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and occupation of Afghanistan. That's what turned it around. So I think the Russians have a long memory in that regard. Plus, they know that the next president, who from their point of view is likely, as of now, if polls today are to be used, is Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton is being backed, surprisingly, by a number of Republican neoconservatives who have come out in recent months, who have distanced themselves from Trump and saying Trump would hurt the Republican Party. And they've outwardly, publicly said that if it's Hillary versus Trump, that they would support Hillary. And Hillary's, even in the Obama administration, when she was Secretary of State, she was more hawkish on Syria than Obama was. So I think the Russians and Putin are seeing this, and so they have a horizon that they feel they need to work within to get a political settlement that secures their strategic interests.
We're talking about Syria. We've got people who are starving to death there on the ground, children, elderly people. They can't get humanitarian aid. What is happening with the ceasefire? The phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Syria, in the Middle East, right next to Turkey. Turkey is a NATO country. It's one reason why we should be so concerned about what's happening in Syria, because if Turkey gets pulled in, we all get pulled in. Also, Syria is becoming the flashpoint between the civil war that we've all feared, the big war we've all feared between the Sunnis and the Shias. They're muscling in on this. We've also got just chaos coming from ISIS. There's a lot happening in Syria. We should be taking a good look at this ceasefire and hoping that it evolves into a complete de-escalation of the issues. But what's going to happen to the leader of Syria, Assad? Many people like President Obama in insists that he has to go. These are just a few of the issues involved in Syria. We can talk about the refugees and the humanitarian problems on the ground. Our phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. As we talk about Syria, you're invited. David Lesh is with us. He is the Ewan Hossell Distinguished Professor of History at Trinity University, author of 14 books, including Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. He was in Brussels and Geneva during the January-February negotiations as part of a small group advising the UN Special Envoy to Syria. What is the worst case scenario? Well, I mean, I've heard people talking about Syria that this could be like pre-World War I Germany, just takes the wrong person to get assassinated and everyone's pulled in.
Right now, the nightmare scenario, in my opinion, is a Turkish-Russian confrontation. We've already had one.
They've shot down two of their planes.
Exactly. So, and the Russians have, of course, laid sanctions on Turkey. Russian jets and special operations troops, as well as their base, are right near the Turkish border. They're carrying out attacks against groups that are supported.
So there have been reports that Putin has threatened Turkey with tactical nuclear weapons.
Yeah, that's a typical Russian and, going back in history, Soviet ploy that they have used in the past and against Turkey on several occasions in history. Now, fortunately, they haven't used them. The U.S. is trying desperately to pressure Turkey not to go beyond the pale that could provoke a Russian-Turkish confrontation in a way that would obligate the United States and NATO to intervene. If the Turks go in offensively into Syria to, as they have been, to take out Kurdish positions, Syrian Kurdish positions and Iraqi Kurdish positions, that doesn't obligate NATO to do anything if they confront the Russians. It's only if Russians attack Turkey. So I think the U.S. is trying to, at the very least, pressure the Turks to just, you know, if they are going into Syria in an offensive manner, to keep it limited, not to confront the Russians or Russian jets. There is more communication, apparently, between U.S. and Russian militaries in terms of coordination so that their mistakes won't happen. But a lot of times that's wishful thinking.
But the Turkey, they've also been attacking Kurds that are in Syria. And that's like, because they don't want the Kurds to establish a homeland in a partitioned Syria.
Yeah, and there's Turkey has drawn a couple of red lines. One red line is the Kurds in Syria have established a corridor in northeastern Syria and a patch of land in northwestern Syria. And there's a little corridor in the middle that is held right now between by Syrian opposition groups. And the Kurds want to connect the two, therefore creating a buffer. And in fact, the Syrian regime wouldn't mind that happening. The Syrian regime has actually been supportive of some of the Kurds' efforts. If that closes, the Turks could act. And I think the U.S. has been trying to pressure the Kurds, pressure the Russians, who are also working with the Kurds, to try to prevent that from happening.
Isn't the United States also working with the Kurds?
U.S. is working with the Kurds, particularly against ISIS, not against the regime, but against ISIS. And the Kurds are working against both in pursuit of their own objectives in carving out this autonomous area that perhaps connecting with Kurdish region in Iraq and elsewhere, you know, might be the beginnings of this long sought after Kurdistan.
So speaking of ISIS, recently President Obama said that ISIS is shrinking. They're losing fighters. Their territory is shrinking. Is that your view?
It is. Probably never as much as an administration will say it is. They tend to exaggerate these things for political purposes. But the information I get is, in fact, the pressure on ISIS that has been there for almost a year and a half, 2 years now, is finally, the cumulative weight of that is finally beginning to be felt.
That's financial pressure?
Financial pressure, particularly the Turks have been a little bit more helpful in this regard. We've pressured some of our Gulf allies to keep funding away from, at least official funding away from ISIS, and we're attacking some of the sources of ISIS revenue directly now. So they're hurting.
It makes you wonder, was this an ideological caliphate, or was this an ongoing criminal enterprise?
Both. you know, it. I guess it's in the eye of the beholder. It's certainly ideological, and certainly the core ideologues in ISIS really believe in what they're doing in terms of recreating an Islamic caliphate. But on the other hand, they also it is a criminal enterprise in terms of extortion, in terms of bribery, in terms of kidnapping, and all of these things in order to keep the ship running.
And so, how is Jordan playing a role in trying to bring some stability back to this area?
Well, Jordan is definitely anti-ISIS. In fact, they just apparently arrested some 20 or 30 suspected ISIS members.
They supposedly stopped some ISIS attack in Jordan.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think they've realized that that is their main enemy. So they've essentially gone along a little bit with the U.S. in terms of turning their focus more toward ISIS and away from Assad. And so they, as well as the U.S., have not been as helpful to the southern front Syrian opposition as we have been in the past, and which is why, in combination with the Russian military intervention in support of the Syrian regime, that the non-jihadist Syrian opposition groups in both the north and the south of Syria have sputtered of late and have lost ground.
So if you're able to get attack ISIS from two fronts, it would be military pressure, as well as they're losing their soldiers because they can't pay them, and then and so maybe if we could remove ISIS from the board of risk here, then the game becomes much simpler.
Well, I think that's what the Russians want right now. Their primary objective is to make this a binary situation in Syria, where it's just the regime versus ISIS, where regime advances will essentially wipe out the non-jihadist opposition, so that there is only a choice between the two. And what is the lesser of two evils? Most in the international community, in the United States, I think we've already made that choice, is the regime of Bashar al-Assad, because he doesn't present direct threat to U.S. interests, and really never has. Therefore, and ISIS does. Therefore, if that happens, if that's the result, I think the Obama administration has acquiesced to that.
So the ceasefire, It's a hot ceasefire. This is not like you can hear the birds chirping. It's like morning again. This is basically, there's not a whole lot of difference between pre-ceasefire and ceasefire.
Yeah, and in fact, again, officially, this is a cessation of hostilities, which is different from a ceasefire. I mean, a ceasefire is something a little bit more official. Now, ceasefires can break down, as we've seen in history, quite easily, but they're usually along the lines of more traditional battle fronts, where two armies separate and there's a demilitarized zone, and perhaps even UN observer forces go in to keep the forces to keep the various armies apart. The end of the 1973 Arab-Israeli War is a classic and fairly successful example of that. This to say, it's very difficult to do something like this in Syria because of the mishmash of various armed opposition groups of different colors. Some who are a part of this cessation of hostilities, some who are not, and then you have Jabhat al-Nusra, who is deemed a terrorist group and is not a part of this cessation of hostilities. They are intermingled with various Syrian opposition, non-jihadist Syrian opposition groups who are a party to this agreement, and therefore are they open to Russian and Syrian government attacks, which has been happening over the last couple of days, seemingly in contradiction to the intent of the cessation of hostilities. So again, it's everyone's different interpretation. There's a very low bar, I think, for meeting the terms of this cessation of hostilities, and I think the U.S. and the Russians are trying desperately to make it seem as if it's working to try to create political space for negotiated settlement that the UN Special Envoy is going to attempt again on March 9th.
So ISIS was not part of the ceasefire, right?
No, so neither was Jabhat al-Nusra.
So it's mainly just between the Syrian state led by Assad, Turkey, and by the Free Syrian Army?
It's between the Syrian government and the High Negotiation Committee, which is an amalgam of Syrian opposition groups, including most Free Syrian Army, as well as some what some would call kind of jihadist groups, like Al-Hara al-Sham and Jaish al-Islam and some of these groups. But Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS are not a party to this. It's also supported by the International Syrian Support Group, which includes 18 countries and as well as the UN and the European Union, and including countries like Iran and Saudi Arabia and Turkey and the U.S. and Russia.
In the meantime, not able to use the ceasefire to provide humanitarian aid to the people who are underground.
I think from the UN perspective, that was one of the primary motives of this cessation of hostilities. Was, again, not only create space for potential negotiations to resume, but to create some space for humanitarian assistance to go through. And some of it has, some of it hasn't. And this is still a very, very serious problem because starvation is being used as a weapon of war by both sides in this conflict, and the Syrian people are suffering for it.
David Lesh is the Ewan Halsall Distinguished Professor of History at Trinity University. He is the author of 14 books, including Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. He was in Brussels and Geneva during the January-February negotiations as part of a small group advising the UN Special Envoy to Syria. David, welcome back. Thank you so much. It was great talking with you.
My pleasure, David.
And this is The Source on KSTX. Thanks for tuning us in.